One of the best courses that I ever took was taught by a man named Richard Pratt. It was part of my doctoral work, and I had not heard of Richard. And I remember when we got the text, I kind of looked at it, and then I read through it. It wasn't clicking, and then I sat in class and was watching what Richard was doing, and I went, oh, that's what it's all about. Richard has a PhD in Old Testament studies, and the name of his book is He Gave Us Stories. And if any of you have been through Honors Bible, you have worked through He Gave Us Stories. But Richard's point was that we tend to think that so much of the gospel and the history of what God is doing is all in these, you know, deep passages like Romans, but so much of what God communicates to us is given to us in stories. And so tonight I'm looking at a character that you may or may not recall. His name is Mephibosheth. But I want to begin with a trivia question. How many of you know who Mr. Mistopheles is? Anybody? A couple of hands, okay. Who is he, Tanya? He's from Cats, all right? And you go, well, what does that have to do with anything? Because when I typed in Mephibosheth, either Word or Google didn't get that far, and they went to Mr. Mistopheles. And he's a lead character in the musical Cats. Now, most people who are familiar with the Old Testament are familiar at least with the story of David. Many people don't know much, may know at least some things about King David. That he was an obscure shepherd, that God chose to be king. Many people, it's often interesting, you know, if you're watching some of the game shows and they'll come up with Bible questions and things. So if you ask about David, people, well, let's say, isn't he the guy that fought the big giant named Goliath? Yes. If they know a little bit more Old Testament history, say, oh, that's right, he's the one who became king after Saul. Yes. And he's the one who had a very close relationship with Saul's son, Jonathan. And then, unfortunately, many people, people remember only two events from David's life. One will be Goliath, and the other will be Bathsheba. I say, okay, you got that, right? So I'm going to focus on this lesser-known character named Mephibosheth. And let me say, it was just fascinating when I offered to fill in for Ed this week, and then saw that Herb was on the list to speak to us tonight. Because there's some lessons from Mephibosheth that tie into exactly what Herb has been talking about in the ministry. Mephibosheth was the grandson of King Saul, and he's the son of Jonathan. And in the midst of a lot of things that were going on, Saul has refuted God in many ways, and God basically said, you're on your own. And Saul goes into battle, and he goes to a witch to find out whether or not he's going to die, because God's not speaking to him because Saul doesn't hear. And Saul and Jonathan go into battle, and Saul and Jonathan are both killed. And the first reference to Mephibosheth, so if you want to look in your Bibles and follow along a little bit, is 2 Samuel chapter 4. I'm going to look at chapter 4, and then I'm going to look at chapter 9. If you're using a Pew Bible, it's page 327. So this first reference, 2 Samuel 4, verse 4, we have not heard of Mephibosheth at this point. Jonathan, son of Saul, had a son who was lame in both feet. He was 5 years old when news about Saul and Jonathan, that is, that they had been killed, came from Jezreel. His nurse picked him up and fled, but as she hurried to leave, he fell and he became disabled. His name was Mephibosheth. So even before you get his name, you're told about his disability. That Mephibosheth is lame in both feet. See, now you have to put this into context. Now, why is this what Richard Pratt said? Why is this story here anyway? Because you really don't learn a lot. You have to get quite a bit farther. So you learn about what has happened, but if you're reading all the history of things that have been going on, what happens? Well, Saul is killed. David becomes king over Judah, the southern tribes. But the northern tribes, where Saul's family has been, There's this massive fight that goes on among the descendants of Saul. So you've got the 10 northern tribes and the 2 southern tribes. David is king in Judah, but there's this thing that's going on up in the northern tribes. And as eventually what will happen is the northern tribes kill everybody, gets killed off, and the northern tribes will come and ask David to become king over all Israel. But after the death of his grandfather, and after the death of Jonathan, and after the death of some of his uncles and all the rest of it, he is a survivor. And he is a political and national threat. However, a lame king would not be able to attract many followers. And Mephibosheth, in many ways, he's not only lame, he's an outcast, and he's virtually unknown. We don't know anything about him except when we start finding this in 2 Samuel. And so what happens is, here's Mephibosheth, and now we know some things, and eventually all the rivals have been killed off. David is now king over all Israel. And in 2 Samuel chapter 9, now you've fast-forwarded over a lot of history, 2 Samuel 9, chapter 9, verse 1. David asked, "Is there anyone left of the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now there was a servant of Saul's household named Ziba. So David's asked the question, is there anybody left? I want to show kindness to somebody, particularly a descendant of Jonathan. And so he said, well, actually, there's a former servant of Saul's, and he's up in the hill country somewhere, okay? And they summon him to appear, and the king says, "Are you Ziba?" And he says, "At your service." The king says, "Is there no one left alive from the house of Saul, now listen to this, to whom I can show God's kindness?" He's really, in a sense, could be a rival. But David goes past his conflict with Saul, the fact that God has made him king, and deals with his relationship with Jonathan. And Ziba says, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He's lame in both feet." "Where is he?" the king asks. And Ziba answers, "He's at the house of Machir, son of Amuel, in Lodabar." Now I have to go back. So David is looking. Is there a descendant? Why is David looking for a descendant, particularly of Jonathan? Because when Saul was trying to kill David and David was running and hiding, it was Jonathan who befriended David. And you have to understand something of that from the perspective of Jonathan. If God is going to make David king, who's not going to be king? Jonathan. And Jonathan would have every reason not to help David. He's going to be the political threat. But it's that Jonathan is a follower of God. And Jonathan realizes that his father is crazy and vile in many ways. And so Jonathan keeps working to protect David and things like that. And then David and Jonathan make this great covenant together. Whatever happens to either of us, the other will make sure that our families are taken care of and protected. And now that David is king, and now that he's gotten rid of some of the other stuff that's going on, it's like, that's right, I made a promise, and now is the time to see if I can fulfill it. And so he sends for Ziba, Ziba informs David, and David sends for Mephibosheth. And I have to acknowledge this. The only sermon I have ever heard on Mephibosheth was preached by R.C. Sproul at a Ligonier conference a number of years ago. And he went on and on in the story, and I'm going, where are you going with this? And you'll see at the end, this is where he went, and this is where we need to be. But if you were the lame grandson of Saul, and the lame son of Jonathan, what would you be most afraid of? That somebody would find out. That somebody in power would find out and decide, I got to make sure there's not going to be any rival. Your genealogy and your family history would make you the natural enemy. I mean, in one sense, how can David know that Mephibosheth won't be like Saul, his grandfather? How does he know he's going to be like Jonathan? You have no physical ability to protect yourself. You have no physical ability to even flee, and you go into hiding, essentially an object of charity. And one day, your worst nightmare comes true. There you are at home, and King's horsemen come up. And they say, we're looking for Mephibosheth. Are you Mephibosheth? And everything that you dread is right before your eyes. And they take you to go see David. See, Mephibosheth's assumption is he's been arrested for punishment. He has every reason to be afraid of David, partly because the covenant between David and Jonathan, I don't believe, is known by their families. Certainly can't be known by Saul. So they don't know what has taken place. He has every reason to be afraid of David, has no reason to think that David is not out to get him, because he's a potential rival. And if you look back again at 2 Samuel 9, so what we find is David sends for Mephibosheth, and you get here's Mephibosheth's interesting response. David had him brought from Lodabar, from the house of Machir, son of Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David. He bowed down to pay him honor. Now, in one sense, what else would you do if you appear before the king? But there's something that's going on here. He has every reason to be afraid. He can't get away, but when he meets David, he responds to him respectively. But he acknowledges David's role and rule, but he doesn't know what to expect. And so here's Mephibosheth's surprise. David calls him by name. Mephibosheth doesn't say, are you the lame son of Jonathan? Doesn't refer to him by his disability. Refers to him by name. He says, at your service. As a matter of fact, in that brief section, David will use Mephibosheth's name 7 times. He keeps referring to him as Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth. All right? And the first thing that David says is, don't be afraid. Well, if you've been dreading what this could be like, you don't need to be afraid. For surely I will show you kindness for the sake of your father, Jonathan. Don't be afraid. I'm going to show you kindness, and I'm going to do it for the sake of your father, Jonathan. And then he proceeds. He offers a word of, here are these words of assurance. It's not a word of captivity or punishment. And again, following ancient Near East patterns, normally when you have a king who comes to power, he slays anybody that's related to the former king to make sure that the path is clear. Instead, David offers a word of restoration. He shows kindness. I'm going to show you kindness. Second thing I'm going to do is I am going to restore all the land that belonged to your grandfather. I don't know if any of you have been to England, or the British Isles, because more than England. I can remember standing one place in one castle far removed, like, what am I looking at? You're looking at royal lands. What does that mean? It belongs to the king. Really? Do you have any idea how much royal land the king and queen of England own? You ever wonder how many castles there are? How come, you know, somebody gets married, oh, here, you can have this castle. Well, how many of these do they have? A lot. I'm going to restore all the lands of your grandfather. That's going to be a lot of land. As a matter of fact, you'll see in just a moment, I'm going to restore all the land of your grandfather. It's an amazing fortune. It will give him an independent income for the rest of his life. But not only is he offered a fortune, then David says, and you will always eat at my table. Mephibosheth is being included in the covenant promise that David and Jonathan made to each other. Eating at a king's table as a permanent guest would have been somewhat abnormal. And if you ever look, you know, have any of you ever been invited to a White House dinner? I mean, I don't even need to ask, do I? No. Okay. Any of you ever been invited anywhere close to the White House for a meal? No. Because kings like to impress other people with who comes to their table for dinner, and you never come to the king's table or the president's table without bringing some kind of a gift, right? But here's the thing. Kings want to impress. So, oh, I've got this noble from over here or this great warrior from over here, and I've got this or that. But nobody invites a lame person to their table. They don't add much to trying to impress other people. And let me just carry this one step further so you understand something. In the Old Testament, in the rules for priests, there was a restriction that if any man had any kind of deformity, any kind, he was ineligible to be a priest. By the time we get to first century Judaism, that prohibition has been extended. Anybody with a disability, a deformity, an issue of blood is not allowed in the temple. And stop and think about the people who Jesus heals. The woman with the issue of blood, she hasn't been able to worship for 40 years. And that's the kind of thing. And so these are the people, these are the least, the lost, and the last. They don't get invited to the king's table, but David invites Mephibosheth. And he's invited to the king table every day. Now think about this. I've wrestled with this, but I don't think it's an overstatement. He's lame in both feet. They don't have electric wheelchairs. They probably don't even have wheelchairs. So if he's going to be at every meal at the king's table, somebody's going to carry him. Every meal, day in, day out. Why? Because the king wants him at the table. And I don't think the king puts him at the far end of the table. This is my brother Jonathan's son, and he will always be welcome at my table. It's an overwhelming invitation. It's an expression of grace and kindness and honor. And then in verse 8, Mephibosheth bowed down and said, "What is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me?" Where did he get the idea he was a dead dog? He got that somewhere. I'm lame. I'm a dead dog. I have no place. Why would you do this? And I want you to get the sense that this is incredible grace that is being demonstrated. And then the king summoned Ziba, Saul's steward, and said, "I have given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. And you and your sons," because Ziba's the king's servant, "you and your sons and your servants are to farm the land for him, bring in the crops, so that your master's grandson may be provided for. And Mephibosheth, grandson of your master, will always eat at my table." Now, how much land is there? Ziba had 15 sons. Then imagine they all get married, and 20 servants. What's he going to do? He's going to take care of all David's land, and he's got enough people to be able to do this. Ziba said to the king, "Your servant will do whatever my lord the king commands his servant to do." So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. He had a young son named Micah, and all the members of Ziba's household were servants of Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem. He's been taken from obscurity. He lives in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table. And then here's the last line. He was lame in both feet. Notice the story begins with, he was dropped when he was 5 years old, and he's lame. And you read the story, and he's lame. And the story ends, oh, by the way, he was lame. So the provision that David makes is a provision for Mephibosheth and his family. And it's also a provision for Ziba and his family. And this story stands out because it's really unusual. Imagine if you're somebody of that period of time, a contemporary of David's, and you read this story like, he brought the lame guy and he ate at his table, which means he's got to be living within the palace region and all those kinds of things. Wow, that's really unusual. So what are the lessons for us? There's two lessons. The first is this, that David is a forerunner of Jesus. When you start doing the genealogy in Matthew's gospel, you go back and you get to David and then you get to Abraham. So there's no question, I'm not making things up, I say, when you look at David and you see some of these things, he's the forerunner of Jesus. He portrays some of these. He's a type of Jesus. But what does that mean for us? It means that you and I are like Mephibosheth spiritually. We're dead dogs. We're lame. We're helpless in our sin. There is nothing to commend us for our salvation. And like Mephibosheth, we need to be drawn to the king's table. You come to the king's table only if you're invited. And Jesus is the one who invites us. Jesus is the one who tells parables about going out and bringing in the lost and the lame and all kinds of other people, the people that are usually there, and I'll bring them into my table. And if you're in Jesus, you have been invited by Jesus, not just to kind of live in obedience, but to join him at the table, to be in fellowship with him like an equal party of what is going on. We are dead, helpless sinners by nature, and we're invited to the king's feast because the king is full of grace. And when Mephibosheth said, well, who am I? That is the question that you and I should be asking. Every time we come up to communion, it's like, who am I to be invited? I have no right to this. And there's a sense which David says, that's right. And it's interesting that the narrative begins with he's lame and it ends with he's lame. So he has nothing to commend himself except the grace of the king. Why are you at the table? Because the king invited me. Do you get here every day like I do? That'd be an interesting question to deal with. Secondly, there is a pastoral lesson for us. Not pertaining to pastors, but pertaining to sheep and ministering to people. David cared for the crippled Melchizedek. And in a similar way, you will see that throughout the ministry of Jesus, as he cares for the weak, the lame, and others who can't get to the table by themselves. Remember the man at the pool? He said, well, I can't get to the pool. But Jesus, in a sense, brings the pool to him and heals him there. In several parables, Jesus tells his servants to go out to the highways and bring in the poor, the blind, and the lame. In one of his most dramatic miracles, the friends of the lame man bring him. They can't even get into the house, so they go up and tear up the roof and drop the lame man down in front of him. What does Jesus do? He says, wait a minute, he can't be here. I could be contaminated by this. No. Instead, he begins by forgiving the man's sins. And the reason he does that is to demonstrate, because there's a little bit of debate going on among the Pharisees, and he says, in order that you might know that I have authority to forgive sins, and he heals the man. It's a demonstration of Jesus' authority. But he doesn't cast out the lame. He doesn't cast out lepers. It's just amazing the number of times that when Jesus ministers to lepers, he doesn't do it from a distance. He touches them. Nobody touches lepers. You can get infected. But Jesus does that. Mephibosheth was important to David. David calls him by name over and over again. He doesn't refer to him as the cripple or the lame man. He treats him with respect and dignity. In the same way, it's just a reminder to us. It really is a reminder. I've been challenged by this. I was thinking about this. I thought, I really need to think about this. Right? Most of us here, on the socioeconomic, educational scale, are way up here. And we don't even think about it. I know those of you who are in college, they're saying, well, I'm entitled to be in college. This is sort of a natural thing for me, instead of going, what am I doing here? And it's easy to forget that and then to think that somehow we've earned it or it's owed to us and to look down on the people around us. One of the most depressing things for me is to go to Walmart like I was yesterday and look at people, well, I don't reserve. I'm like, oh man, that is so awful. That is so ugly. Instead of saying, you know, there's people that really need help. Needy people are important to Jesus. We see it through his ministry, both in his teaching and his actions. And he often takes time for people the rest of the society had cast off, like the woman at the well. Nancy and I have been watching some British serials. Serials, right? And it's just interesting. The British class society, we've been watching a series recently with a woman doctor, and she's way down in the poor neighborhoods, and the other kinds of people come along, the upper class. Why would you waste your life down there? We've got this really nice hospital, yeah, for people who can afford it. And it's just the thing that's there. Mephibosheth was invited to dine at the king's table. In a similar way, you and I are the lost, broken, dog-like children of Adam and Eve are invited to the Lord's table. And having experienced his grace, saying, I don't deserve this, then Jesus calls us to show that same grace, that same care to the needy in our own communities, in our own neighborhoods, whether their needs are physical or mental or emotional or spiritual. And I want to say this because it's so current, I'm not going to get political, but in the midst of our national concern about border security, and I get it, But we are the places where we are the place people come as a refuge to escape terrible and awful things. I don't have an immediate solution. I don't think it's let's not have a wall, but you're going to have some kind of security. But do we care about those people? Stop and think for a moment how many people Mother Teresa just puzzled. Why would you give your life ministering to those people? Oh, because that's what God's called me to do. And that's just the challenge for us. And I'm glad we're supporting the kind of thing that Herb is trying to do and others are trying to do and be involved in some of those things. See, David fulfilled his covenant promise to Jonathan. And Jesus fulfills the Father's covenant love for his people. So let us see ourselves, like Mephibosheth, as recipients of covenant grace and love. And let us be those who, like David and like Jesus, show covenant grace and love to others. Let's pray.